Ever feel like those real estate contracts are kind of like, well, minefields? I mean, all those clauses and contingencies and what ifs. Today, we're going to tackle one that trips up a lot of folks, even seasoned pros.
Yeah, those escape hatches, right? Those contingency clauses that are supposed to give you some breathing room in the deal. But what happens when one side tries to use one to back out and the other's left high and dry?
That's exactly what we're diving into. We're dissecting a case, Vose v. Donovan, that went all the way to appeals court just to figure out if a contingency clause was legit or just a way to wiggle out of a commitment. Buckle up, because this one's got twists and turns.
It's a classic example of how courts try to balance the need for flexibility in real estate deals with the need to make sure contracts are actually, binding.
All right, let's set the stage. It's 2007. The Voses are selling their home, and the Donovans agree to buy it. Price tag, $550,000. But there's always a but, right? The contract had a contingency clause. It said the deal was subject to sellers obtaining home of their choice on or before February 20, 2007.
Okay, so a pretty standard, gotta find my next place clause. Lots of sellers use those. What's the catch?
Well, at the same time, the Voses had a counteroffer out on another property. Deadline for that offer to be accepted, February 19th, just one day before their contingency deadline with the Donovans.
Tight timeline.
Yeah.
So, did they get their home of choice?
They did. The counteroffer was accepted right on time within the deadline, and they promptly informed the Donovans. You'd think, okay, contingency met, let's move forward.
But that's not what happened.
Nope. The Donovans, despite knowing the Voses had fulfilled their part of the contingency, decided they didn't want to buy the house after all. The Voses, understandably, felt like the rug had been pulled out from under them.
Yeah, breach of contract time. Did they sue?
Oh, they did. Went straight to court. Now, the first ruling, believe it or not, was in favor of the Donovans. The trial court said that subject to sellers obtaining home of their choice was way too vague. Basically, the Donovans argued it gave the Voses an out anytime they wanted.
So, the court agreed the clause was too open-ended.
Pretty much. They said it didn't require the Voses to actively look for another home or meet any specific criteria. It was all based on their personal feeling about whether they'd found the perfect place, which could be, well, anything.
Ah, I see. The court was worried it was what we call an illusory promise, meaning it didn't actually obligate the Voses to do anything, just a way to walk away if they changed their mind.
Bingo. And that's a problem for contracts. A real contract needs clear terms, a meeting of the minds, as they say, where both sides know exactly what they're agreeing to.
Right, and it needs consideration, that back and forth exchange of something valuable. If one side's promise is totally up in the air with no real commitment, then it's not really a valid contract.
Exactly. Now, before you think this is all about real estate jargon, hold on. This case gets to the heart of what makes a contract tick, something any future lawyer needs to grasp.
Yeah, it's about proving both parties were on the same page, that they understood what they were getting into. The words matter, but so does the context.
Okay, so the Voses lose in trial court. Case closed.
Not so fast. They appealed, and things got interesting. The appeals court took a harder look at the situation and actually reversed the decision.
Whoa, so the contingency clause was enforceable after all. What changed?
The appeals court emphasized that you can't just look at a contract in a vacuum. You have to see it in the context of the whole deal, what each party knew and was doing at the time.
So the court played detective a little bit.
You could say that. They honed in on that very short deadline in the clause, the on or before February 20th part. It wasn't a leisurely house hunt. It was a taut window.
Yeah, implying the Voses weren't just browsing casually. They had something specific in motion.
Exactly. That's where this extrinsic evidence comes in, the stuff that wasn't explicitly written in the contract but was part of the bigger picture. Remember the Voses' pending counteroffer on that other house?
With the February 19th deadline, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's crucial. The appeals court said, and this is a direct quote, "The undisputed facts support a reasonable inference that the Donovans did know of the pending transaction." Basically, they knew about that other offer. And that, the court said, provides definiteness to the meaning of the condition that the Voses obtain a home of their choice by February 20, 2007.
Hold on, let me unpack that. The court's saying, because the Donovans knew about that other offer and its deadline, they knew exactly what the Voses meant by home of their choice, and that they weren't just messing around.
Precisely. It wasn't some vague wish. It was tied to a specific real-world event that was already in play. That knowledge on the Donovans' part made the clause concrete.
Okay, so the Donovans can't claim ignorance. They knew the deal. But what about that illusory promise thing? The trial court said the Voses had total control over whether they found a home.
Right, but the appeals court said, Not so fast. It wasn't entirely up to the Vosses. They had to rely on a third party, the seller of that other house, to accept their offer.
Ah, so it was a genuine condition, not just a whim. They had to wait and see what that other seller decided.
Exactly. To quote the court again, when the extrinsic evidence is considered, there is a reasonable inference that whether the Vosses' counteroffer will be accepted by the deadline is not wholly under their control or left wholly to their own will and discretion.
So the Vosses were bound by their agreement, but that agreement hinged on something outside their control. That makes it a true contingency, not just a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. And it highlights a key principle. Courts want contracts to work. They're not going to throw them out unless there's a really good reason.
Yeah.
If you can show there was a legitimate purpose behind a clause, even if the wording isn't perfect, it'll hold up much better in court.
This case is a prime example of how you can't just skim a contract. You got to understand the whole story, the players, the motivations.
Absolutely. Courts are all about figuring out what the parties truly intended. They're not going to get bogged down in legal nitpicking if they can see a clear agreement, even if it's not spelled out perfectly.
So, big takeaway from Vos v. Donovan.
Contingency clauses are more likely to stick if they've got some objective measure, like a deadline, and if their success depends on things outside one party's control. The more specific and less discretionary, the better.
Sound advice for anyone drafting contracts, especially those future lawyers out there.
Yeah, when you're writing these things, think specificity. Don't just say subject to finding a suitable property. Say subject to closing on a property under contract by date or something equally specific. And if you can tie it to a real-world event, even better.
Less room for arguments later, right?
Exactly. And remember, context is king. What did the parties know? What was the situation when they made the deal? That background info is gold when you're trying to figure out what a contract really means.
So aspiring legal eagles, if you're ever in court arguing a contract case, don't just quote the text, dig into the story behind it. It might be your strongest weapon.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And finally, remember, courts generally try to uphold contracts. They want to see agreements honored. So if you can make a solid case that a clause is reasonable, given the whole context, you're in much better shape.
All right, let's throw a curveball. What if the Donovans claim they never knew about the Vosses' other offer? How would the appeals court have viewed that definiteness issue without that crucial piece of information?
Ooh, great question. That knowledge was really central to the court's decision. If the Donovans were truly in the dark about the other offer and its deadline, the home of their choice clause would have seemed way more vague and subjective. The short deadline might have raised an eyebrow, but without knowing the specifics, it would be tough to argue that the Donovans understood exactly what they were agreeing to. The court even said it straight out. The undisputed facts support a reasonable inference that the Donovans did know of the pending transaction. That knowledge was their trump card. Without it, the outcome might have been different, possibly echoing the trial court's initial ruling.
So in contract law, sometimes it's not just what you know, it's what you can prove the other side knew.
Exactly. Vos v. Donovan shows us that the words of a contract matter, but the context, the shared understanding, that's often what seals the deal.
Context is key, folks. It's not just legal fluff. It's what breathes life into those agreements and helps courts figure out what's fair and what's not. So next time you're dealing with a contract, even if it's just for a parking space rental, don't just sign on the dotted line. Think about the bigger picture, the unspoken assumptions, the things everyone knows but maybe hasn't explicitly stated. And if you're ever in doubt, talk it through. Clarity up front can save a lot of headaches later.
Couldn't agree more. Contracts are all about communication, and sometimes what's not said can be just as important as what is. All right, listeners, that's something to chew on. Until next time, keep those contracts tight and those intentions clear.
And that wraps up another deep dive. Catch you next time, folks.